Welcome to Brain Injury Conversations. Hello, I'm Cynthia. Today's episode is with Peter Rudland, who was a soldier in Afghanistan for the Australian Defence Force. I need to give a warning that for some people, parts of this conversation may be difficult to hear, but it's a conversation definitely worth listening to, as it also gives hope and inspiration. Peter Rudland was involved in a horrific Black Hawk helicopter crash that changed his life and the lives of others. At times, during his recovery, he thought it had taken his life. Now, he's very much full of life and humour. As an ambassador for the RSL and who has co-captained the Australian team at the Invictus Games twice. As he explains, there's been many changes in his habits, behaviour, relationships, and more. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Welcome to Brain Injury Conversations. Can you tell us what happened to you and where you were and what you were doing at that time?
So I was a soldier. I was in Special Operations. I served within Special Operations or in the Defence Force for nearly 30 years. On a tour of Afghanistan in 2010, I was in a helicopter that crashed as part of the Battle of Shawalikot, which is a battle honour for Australian soldiers for the Afghan War. It crashed on the last day of the targeting serials for that operation.
Who was in the helicopter with you?
So it was a mixture of Australian and US troops. So the US were the flight crew, so the loadmasters, flights, a US interpreter, slant Afghan, and then members of two commando regiment. So one of the teams and a sub-portion of my command element.
How long had you been in Afghanistan at that point?
So rotations for special operations are generally 4 month rotations. We were a couple of days from going home. So my men would have gone home probably within 2 days of that operation finished, and I would have gone home probably 7 days. So I would have been a part of the handover with the new force element coming in.
Right, so you were coming to the end of your 4 months.
The very end. Would have been probably my last time outside the wire. Technically it was.
Unfortunately. And what happened?
So coming in on a target, it was very, very early in the morning, and it was one of those particularly dark nights. And in the Defence Force, it comes under a category called Red Alum. So you have to seek further permission and have mitigators to fly in those sort of conditions. The pilot...
Was it a very mountainous part of Afghanistan?
No, actually, it was in my memory... I have this thing of mountains, but in the reality, because I've seen the photographs and all that sort of thing, it wasn't. We were 3 minutes away from the target location, and at the three-minute mark, that's where the troops inside the aircraft start to prepare themselves for disembarkation. The aircraft also drops from its flying altitude down to around 50 feet, because when you come in...
50 feet?
Yeah, so it masks the sound of the aircraft's approach. You know, if you hear an aircraft and you go outside and you go, oh, there it is, and you look up.
Yeah.
You know, it's easily spotted. But if it's coming in at low level, you go, where's that coming from? You know, it masks that sound, it masks the location. Right. So as we came down from 1,000 feet to 50 feet, the pilot pushed through the 50-foot threshold and clipped the ground. So we clipped the ground. It was mainly flat ground, and there was a bit of a wadi. And the pilot managed to hit the other side of the wadi with the front wheel. And then the front wheel, and that's about the time that I looked down. I'd put my night vision goggles on, looked down and just went, oh, you know, and it was right in front of me. So we clipped and then rolled over once, and then it then turned sideways, and we continued to roll as the aircraft broke up. And it rolled about six times and snapped the front and the back end away and then caught fire.
And you were still in the aircraft at that point?
No, I got ejected. So I was... All members of the aircraft are stropped into the aircraft. I had put my strop onto the back portion of the aircraft just where the door. So a strop, so what you have is a belt, it's called a Black Hawk belt, and you have that around your waist. And then a belt takes you, a strop is the lead that goes from your the belt that you have on to the ground, right. Or to the aircraft, yep. A fixed point in the aircraft. And that is elasticized. So, you know, if there was any, you know, sudden stop of the aircraft, it's supposed to take up rather than, you know, just have a strop and snap. A strop to the aircraft, the strop broke, also breaking my pelvis and my hips and my back and all that sort of stuff as part of that. But I got ejected from the aircraft on one of those rolls and been told that I was found about 35 meters on the left-hand side away from the aircraft.
Right.
I can vaguely remember sort of waking up because there were some other guys around me as well. Mm-hmm. And I remember the helicopter, because there was four helicopters. I was the lead helicopter within it. I can remember the other two sort of overflying, come round. They started to, I don't really remember them overflying. I just know they did. They came around behind us, and then the guys ran out and started to, you know, to sort of start first aid and start patching
those
up.
How many of you were in your helicopter?
I think there's 15 from total. So 10 Australian, 5 American, yeah. So 15. Three Australian KIA, one American KIA.
Can you explain that?
Killed in action.
Wow. And from there, where were you taken to, Peter?
Put on a chopper, flown to Kandahar. Kandahar did the initial, the hospital in Kandahar. So they do the initial stabilisation for a move to Germany. So basically, you know, in the morning, Kandahar, in the afternoon, aircraft to Germany.
So Germany, because that's a major military hospital for
Landstuhl.
The world, really, isn't it? For Europe, yeah.
All the best doctors are in at Landstuhl. They've got the greatest facilities, you know, and it's close proximity really to get around. So you go there, you get operated on. That's where they basically, you know, putting you back together and saving your life, and then you, once you're stable from those initial round of surgeries, you put on a plane and go home, and that's exactly
how
what
long
happened.
Were you in hospital in Germany for?
A bit over a week.
And is that where they possibly realised that you may have had a brain injury? And how did they first recognise that?
Yeah, I'm laughing because it's not the best story, but it's a funny story.
But it's a story, yes.
So when I was put in the hospital at Kandahar, so, you know, they had, you know, all these medical staff there. They had all these beds lined up. They brought me in. I was at the bend at the end. They cut all your clothes off you. They realised that I had significant injuries in the, like, so my right arm was broken and squashed just below the elbow. So that was an obvious one. My leg, the rifle embedded in my leg, and the guys had put a tourniquet on my leg to stop the bleeding. So again, no brainer, it was an obvious one. My ribs all on my right side were broken. I had screamed when they picked me up. So I was wearing the stretcher and it was completely destroyed, called a talon stretcher. So they picked me up and I was screaming, so they knew there was a back-related injury. So they knew they had that collection of musculoskeletal sort of injuries.
Like physical injuries, yes.
Yeah. So they were aware of that. And then, so I was laying there on the bed and I was naked, and one of the nurses leaned over the top of me and I grabbed her on the breast and told her she had nice breasts. And the doctor said there was another sergeant there, one of my guys, they said, would he do
that
something
knew
like
you?
That? Yeah, that knew me quite well. They said, would he do something like that? And he goes, oh, Jesus, no. You know, like, so then that started them down the path, that line of
maybe something
questioning,
else is not
yeah.
quite right here.
The level of pain that I was experiencing at the time with the amount of injuries that I had wasn't also conducive you know, so I didn't have enough pain for the amount of breaks that I had when I was, you know, almost a resting state, unless, you know, someone tried to pick me up. So with the two of those together, they thought that I had had a brain injury. So the swelling on the brain was masking the pain element, and also because
Which
it was
it
a frontal lobe.
Strange way, doesn't it? Yeah.
Well, on Crestside, I sat up.
Yeah, until everything sort of settles back down again, and then the pain is really accentuated.
Before the guys got to me, when the chopper came up, I can remember, you know, like I had the stretcher on my back, and so it'd give me that propped up position, I suppose, the sitting up. And I had to look back over my shoulder to see the chopper, so I was, you know, looking at the chopper, I was calling out to the guys, you know, I was having a conversation. As the fire broke out, I had, you know, instructed people to go and I could see the silhouette of a soldier next to the fire, and I was like, you know, go and do this and go and that. And then one of the guys said, you know, Pete, you don't look so good. You should probably worry about you right now. And that it just, I was able to function and do all of those things. And I didn't really understand that I'd been in a helicopter crash either. You know, I knew that I was completely covered in dust. Around that time, I remember one of the medics saying to the other, you know, Pete's leg doesn't look so good. And I looked at my leg, and because I had all this dust and I was completely, you know, like just caked in it almost. And
So it was a dry waddy.
Oh yeah, it was dry. Yeah. There was no water anywhere. And and I was also on the top of the other side of it, you know, and where the aircraft had hit and then rolled sort of through. And but the blood from my leg was like eating the ground. As it pushed further and further out profusely, it was like eating into the dust and
so
creating
like acid into the dust.
No. It was like it was on top of it, but it was like, you know, you see the, you know, the volcano stuff where it comes across and eats
like
and
lava.
Turns and
yeah.
And that's what it sort of did. And I was watching it grow, going, hey, that's really cool. And then one of the guys was saying, you know, like, we need to stop that, he's going to die. And I was like,
that's
really?
That's too much blood in the ground.
And that, I think those little things that sort of said to me, you know, like, I'm not really processing real well on this, you know. And I was trying to weigh up, you know, did I just have shock or, you know. But they were all of those little things when I had further conversations with the guys later, you know, which were all those indicators that had brain injury, you know. Considering I was sort of trapped between the aircraft as it was rolling as well, and the ground, and then my body armor and my helmet is sort of what saved my life. And they reckon that the helmet had twisted on my head and was sort of sideways, and it had probably taken the impact across. And so it stopped me from squashing my head, but it wasn't enough to protect me from the, you know, the severity of the
head injury.
Your brain's
sitting in fluid, and it's just being bounced around inside your skull, basically. Mm. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
You would have absorbed some of it, but not all of it.
Yeah, no, yeah. You did a bloody good job of absorbing a lot. And when you think, it, you know, only got a frontal lobe bleed.
What could have happened?
Exactly. Well, the dude next to me, without going into names, he had a fairly significant impact to the top of his head. And there was a fairly large dent through his helmet and into the top of his head. Wow. And he was sort of laying just next to me.
So you were aware that he was there?
Yeah, I was aware that he was dead, which was really, it was a weird thing, you know, like the guys were working on him and one of the medics, but it was really aware. There was my three guys who died on the crash site. I was sort of aware they were dead before I was told they were dead. I don't even know how to process that one, and I never really have it, but it's always been an underlying thought within my head that I knew that.
You knew that already. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's how long had you been with those guys, Pete?
We had been working together for, as in that particular, you know, sort of, you know, body of men. We'd been together for about 12 months for the lead up for that tour. I'd just come back from a posting to the parachute school. And, you know, we had been given our warning order to go, so we were building up for the trip. But, you know, the guys I had known for significant times beforehand. You know, two of the guys had come across from one of the other companies that I'd known in various capacities. One had been around the system as long as I had. So I'd known him for a while as well, and he was a good friend. He was, you know, great bloke to talk to, and at my rank level, to have somebody that I considered a peer, even though that he didn't have the same rank as me. He'd given his rank up to come across the spur. Sorry?
What's a PE?
Peer.
Peer.
You know, so he was he'd been in the Defence Force as long. He'd been a sergeant. He had had his subjects for warrant, and so did I, so warrant officer. When he came across to Special Operations, you have to relinquish your rank, and he had done so.
Oh, okay.
So he had started again. So, so we had discussed, you know, many aspects of that, and it was great to be able to just sit down and, you know, have a friend around the same age group to throw ideas off. You know, nobody gets it right all of the time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what it is. That's the nature of the beast.
So from Germany.
Yep.
After you'd been there and they'd basically put you back together as well as they could so you were stable enough to travel,
mm-hmm.
you came back to Australia. Where to in Australia?
So I went to Westmeath. I suppose I'll go back a little bit. So when they put mm-hmm. me, so they organised the move from Germany and they basically did a full body cast on me, and the idea was to put me to sleep for the flight home. I remember, you know, getting into the bus at the hospital in Germany to go to the airport, and it was just, you know, like really weird being so
so a full immobilized. Body cast.
From what I remember, yes, I was completely unable to move at all, sort of thing. They put on two aircraft, so they had one in Diego Garcia, so we flew because air crew hours. So they flew us to Diego Garcia and then moved into the other aircraft and then flown home. My memory of the aircraft stuff was, I suppose, when I was really aware of a brain injury. I was very, very confused all of the time, and the things that came out of my mouth were quite bad in most cases. But I thought we were in a storm, like, the whole time, and I thought there was this screaming of a storm outside, like violent, like really like in movie-type storms.
Really?
And I subsequently got to speak to guys who were there. And they said, no, there wasn't, Pete. There wasn't a sound. It was just the, you know, normal aircraft flight. There was no storm, no nothing. So, and I remember waking up and I remember calling out to people, and they came over, asked me if I was comfortable and that type of stuff. And then they said, you know, it's best you go back to sleep. So I went back to sleep. So so I wasn't really awake for long periods, but the times that I was awake, it was really weird. There's a lot of strange stuff going on in my head.
And,
Well, when I was in Germany and I woke up, so the old brain injury, you know, it's such a strange thing. Initially, I had no memory of the crash. So I was in my room in Tarinkout in Afghanistan, and I had to do, I have an input into the orders group. I also had to do the seating plan with one of my friends, Gary, who was in the helicopter as well, for our particular helicopter. I got up from my room, you know, from stuff out. I went and did a couple of things. I then had one of the soldiers come to my room and ask me a little bit about our particular mission and some of the finer points of what him and I needed to do. And I was trying to kick him out of my room because I wanted to watch the rest of me. You know Zombie Land?
Yes.
And I was trying to kick him out of my room because I wanted to finish it all off, you know, beforehand. And so I pressed pause, and I'd leant forward, pressed pause, and it was on a, you know, like a, on a black lounge, and I was sitting on another lounge, and I was just trying to, you know, sort of pull my laptop closer to watch it. And because sergeants in Afghanistan, bravos at my level, we have our own room and everybody else shares. So he was like looking around going, oh, you guys live the good life. And I'm like, just get out, I want to watch my movie. And as I leaned over to press play to watch it again, that was when I woke up in Germany. So in my head, I had lost.
So you missed all that.
I missed everything initially. So it took a while for stuff to come back. But the crazy thing was, it was like instantaneous. It was like blinking. You know.
And did it all come back at once?
Oh, no. Oh, no, no. It took a while. So when I woke up, I had my leg elevated with the hole in my leg. I had no function on arms and legs properly. And I'm like looking at this leg and I'm going, who's is that? You know, this huge,
so
big hole in my leg. And
disconnected.
It made no sense. It was like I was in somebody else's body. And I was like, what? And I started trying to pull all the tubes out. And then I fell off the bed. And then I was like floundering on the ground. And one of the nurses had come in and found me. And I heard her scream out, like, you know, he's awake and he's out of bed. And then the doctor came through. He was quite calm. You know, he's like, it's all right. I got him, and he basically shoved a needle in me and said, good night, little fella. And that's what I did.
Just put you back to sleep.
So I went back to sleep, and then I woke up a little bit later in a bed, and my very good friend, who I'd worked with for many years, was standing in front of the room. So he had the doorway, and then the room, he was outside, and he was talking, and I, I asked, like, I woke up and said, what are you doing here? And then he started yelling out, go and get his brother. Go get his brother, Pete's awake. So the Defence Force had flown my brother to Germany and the families of the other wounded guys.
Wow.
And they were all in there having a brief about our various conditions. And then...
And I should ask you, Pete, what year was this?
Sorry. 2010.
2010.
Yeah. But from that point, things went really bad for me in the sense the brain injury was really dominating and my pain was tremendously painful. Everything was pain and I wasn't allowed to eat or drink or any of that sort of stuff. And I was allowed to suck on some ice. And because I couldn't understand anything, I assumed I was dead. And because of the... So my brain injury was a little bit different from others, but they're all so very different.
Very different.
And so what I had was I had myself believing I was dead, but the way that they sort of explained things to me was, as I try to sort of bring that out to doctors and that because half the reason I thought that I was dead was because every time I looked at something, it was different. So say if I looked across my room and there was a basin in the corner of my room and it was on my right-hand side, you know, if I could close my eyes and went to sleep, for example, and then I looked over, the basin was on the left-hand side and the door had changed. Or, you know, the people seemed different. And what they were trying to say was because of the disruption in my neuropathways, my brain's trying to find new ways to do it.
To do it.
And because it was reaching a disruption point and then having to go somewhere else, there was a distortion in what I was seeing and what was being processed. So I seen it different, and because of the pathways trying to find which was better, showed it to me slightly different each time.
Yeah, so there's a different perspective all the time until it sort of got itself around.
Yeah. Well, it was like that for a while, and the worst thing is, I suppose, because I thought I was dead, then I thought there was no consequence to anything I said. And then,
I thought something,
I was zero filter. You know, I mean, the things that I said were so bad. And, you know, to some of the nursing, you know, I had an African-American nurse. I was horrible to her. And I had a gay nurse and I was horrible to him. I was just brutal to everybody. The things I said. And I went around and apologized. And so it wasn't quite so bad in Germany, but, you know, that push back into Australia where I got really bad because I had, you know, a lot of big surgeries in Australia and that pinged me straight back to where I was. And after I saw those series of them, though, I could do everything. I got to a stage that... So I had two people inside my head. There was myself, shaven, haircut, rational, and then I had long hair, beard, and violent. And it was really weird to watch... You know, like myself fight against control. And the violent side, you know, here's where the kid comes out in here, because you think yourself, you know, like Star Wars, you know, like dark, you know, light will prevail.
Dark and light, yeah.
Dark always won. Dark always won. You know, the pathway to darkness, you know, is rage, and rage is free.
So strong.
You know, it just runs and does what it wants. There's no controlling, you know, rage. And this is the way I looked at it anyway. Mm. But to actually, you know, try to control yourself requires thought and process, you know. And, you know, it's almost...
concentration and focus.
It was hard to do that.
You don't have that focus to, like, pull it down and to,
Brother, so, yeah, I just find the violent person one every time. The person who would say, okay, you know, this person's good, they're nice, you know, please don't swear at them. They're, you know, they've been nothing but lovely to you. And the other side would just go, yeah, bullshit, stop that. Bam, unload. And it would always happen. And also I was aggressive with everyone. And then, so here's my little thing that I learned out of it all. So my mother had cognitive issues towards the end. And so whenever I tried to explain myself to somebody, I could, you know, I had a thought inside my head, but by the time it got to my mouth, it wasn't what I was thinking. So I would get frustrated. And I remember laying in my bed, looking up at the roof, going, why can't I bring it from my brain to my mouth? Or why can't this person understand what I'm clearly trying to tell them? So I'd get frustrated and I'd just switch off and wouldn't want to talk to anybody. But then when you're sitting with somebody with, say, dementia, they do the same thing. They do exactly the same thing. I watched my mum just like, you know, try to say something, and then get frustrated with me. And I went, I recognise that.
And it's like they're in there, but they just can't get it out.
Can't articulate themselves.
Just can't get it out.
So it
but
really
they're
made
in
me
there.
Think.
They're in there.
Yeah. So it was really weird. You know, I think it made me, you know, like want to cuddle my mum more and just tell her, it doesn't matter if you can't communicate. You know, like I get it. You know, I get the frustration. I get everything. Just know that I love you on the way out sort of thing. So I think for that sense, it was good. And I got to speak to my neuro a lot about it. And just saying, you know, because he couldn't believe I could remember some of the things. And then I would, you know, tell him I would see those same frustration stuff in my mum's face and all that sort of stuff in the subsequent years. So I suppose it was good for him to understand that as well.
To have that perspective from that side, yeah. I think that's a really interesting point from their perspective as well, yeah.
I went through a phase as well in hospital that I wanted to kill myself. And, I never... so I'm not the type of... you know, doing for suicide or anything like that. You know, I fully love life and I want to live a very, very long one. But what I got it into my head was, because it was all a dream and because it was, I was, you know, again, in the early days thinking I was dead and all that sort of stuff, I believed if I'd killed myself, if I could find a way to kill myself, I would wake up. That I would wake up from this this strange, abnormal reality thing that I was in. That I'd be Pete again, you know, and I might wake up and find myself back
so
in Afghanistan or something like that.
That person, you'd come back to a normal life.
I used to say to a lot of people, you know, like, you know, the Minister of Defence and all these people come to visit me, and I would ask them stupid questions like, is my rifle behind me? You know, like, as if it was, you know. Like, but I mean, I always had this thought, if I could just work out how to kill myself. But
That bit of you, or,
I would wake up. And like, you know, lucky enough that, you know, that went away in time and I got my to understand things. But I was able to, so they put me on a Stilnox. And Stilnox made me more aggressive for a short period of time, but then eventually dissolved the second part of my brain. So I became, you know, back towards being Peter again. And I was able to have, you know, conversations that went somewhere. You know, and I understood things better. And, you know, when people, because people continue to explain to me, you know, you had a helicopter crash and, you know, your injuries are, you know, of, you know, they come from that and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, lots of people come to, anybody, you know, sort of in government, they all come to see me as part of that. So I was trying to, you know, like, well, why else would these people come to see me? You know, so I got there in the end, but it just took a bit of time and the brain injury... improved. It, you know, continued to improve.
But it's not like fixing, like, a broken arm or a broken leg or...
No.
How long were you in Westmead for?
Oh, a couple of months. A few months and that. And then I went from there to a military hospital.
And you were doing rehab on your body as well at that point as well.
I first sat up and first... you know, got into a wheelchair and all that sort of stuff at Westmead. I did some limited walking at Westmead and then, you know, went across to the military hospital. Once I left the ICU, they put me on the cardiac ward, which was right next to...
Why the cardiac ward?
Because it was right next to
The
ICU, so they could still, the staff
could
still look in on me.
Strongly monitor you.
There was an amazing matron of the ICU ward and she kept us close. And she kept me particularly close. Every morning she came in, she woke me up with a cup of tea and all that sort of stuff. And
so you mustn't have been too bad to her.
No, I wasn't bad. It was more like statements of offence that she had worked in an ICU for a long time.
Yeah.
And she understood it. But some people, I think, aren't probably suited to their professions. There was a guy called Damascus who used to come in every morning, and he was this little black fellow, and he goes, "Hello, my name is Damascus, like the city." He goes, "I know you will not remember tomorrow, but I will tell you every day, and one day you will remember me." And he was the most lovely guy, and I would, you know, tell him to get out of my room or whatever, you know, blah blah blah, and he had a smile with everything he did. You know, he would check me. He would, you know, check, open a window or whatever he would do. You know, he would just do it with a smile on his face, regardless of what was said. But then there was this very large lady who, she was basically rude. And I proceeded to tell her what I thought of her. And then he, there's another story. But he When I went to apologise to her once the brain injury stuff had all cleared and I'd gone to the cardiac ward, and I did, I went around to every single person that I could remember and said, you know, I am so sorry for the things that I said. That is not me. I am not a racist. I am, you know, I'm not a homophobe or any of that sort of stuff. You just got angry, Peter, that I had no control over. And I apologise for any offence that I may have caused. Everybody said, no worries, we get it. You know, you had a brain injury, mate, you know. But she turned to me and she said, no, I don't accept your apology. She goes, there's something deep down dark wrong with you. And I was like, really? And she goes, the hate that you said, you know, the things that you said to me, I will never forget. And I just sort of went, well, you live with that then, darling, walk away. You know, I wasn't going to sit there and stew over it. You know, I gave her my apology. And like I said, you know, I'm not racist. My brother's dad's as black as the ace of spades. You know, we're not those sort of people.
That's all you can do.
Yeah. And another one of my brothers is gay. You know, again, you know, I love my brother and all that sort of stuff. So I'm not that person of hate. It's just why I had the injury. There was so much hate. My mother with hers, she was really, really mean to anybody who wasn't white. And I thought that was really funny as well, because my mother, again, is not that person. Yeah. But it was so funny. You just find something, you know, there's a hole and you put your finger in it and you try to make it bigger. You know, it brings that, I don't know, the confusion brings hate or not hate, but I don't like to use it as hate, but
no,
you just want to go after something.
There's
a focal point.
Yes. So after you left Westmead and you went to a military rehab?
I went to a military hospital, yeah.
Yep. What sort of rehab did you do?
Well,
so physically and brain injury?
I manipulated the hospital really, really badly, and my then partner. I had had enough. I'd really, really had enough. You know, laying in a bed, I couldn't wipe my own bum.
Hospital
and people.
Being told and what to do and where you are. And
well, there's only so long you can look at the roof and join the dots on a roof. You know, I think I watched Bear Grylls a million times because it was the only thing on TV. I just had enough. I needed to see some other walls. I needed to see other people. It was around the time that I was really starting to take ownership of my pathway. So I got to the military hospital, and then from the very start, I told everybody that was me. I'm done. I'm going home. And they said, there's a couple of things you need to be able to do. Right. Because of the house that I lived in, so I had basic functions, and there was a mixture between the brain injury and the physical element. I had to have had to show that I wasn't going to burn a house down, sort of stuff, and I was also, you know, capable of thought pattern that was appropriate, plus also complete those tasks to be inside a house. Now at that stage, I couldn't wipe my own bum, I couldn't dress myself, I couldn't shower myself, I couldn't do anything. So a couple of days before they assessed me in hospital, I was going to the physios every day, and I said to the physios, this is what I need to achieve.
Yeah.
And they said, we'll show
just
you.
Just teach me this.
Yeah. I said, I don't want to know
don't
anything
care
else.
Don't anything else.
Exactly.
Just
teach
this.
Me that. So I did that, and then, so funny thing happened, that there was, at the military hospital, there was two civilian nurses who were the laziest, most disgusting animals that have ever walked the earth. Just sat there and did not care about one of us. And, they actually said to us, if we were in the military, or said to me, if I was in the military, I'd be an officer and I'd outrank you. And I said, well, you're not, so do your bloody job. And what she didn't know was the CO of the base and the RSM were personal friends I'd known for many, many years. So I made them very aware of the things that she was saying and doing. And it was good to see they got moved on in the end. But the catalyst of that was, so I was laying in bed and I couldn't go to the toilet. And I couldn't work out how to get to the toilet. It was only just in front of me. So they had
little... Yeah, it's like, how can I work this out?
I didn't do a good job of it. It was a mess. It was a dog's breakfast. But there was like this walker, and they'd removed the wheelchair from me. And I thought, I can do this. I got onto this walker, and I dragged myself across into the toilet. And I was so proud of myself. I was like, yeah, leg function, yeah. Not good, but I'm there. So I got into the toilet. But then I had the thing like, how do I get down onto a toilet from where I was?
Because they're much lower than you think.
They're a hell of a lot lower. And with no muscle control at all. So I'm like,
and
I can get down.
And nothing really to hang on to necessarily.
Nope. Nothing to hang on. So I did my little fall, which hurt like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, because they're frigging tiled rooms.
Yep. So I did my biz on the toilet. And then I realised I couldn't clean myself up, so that was an issue. And I'm thinking, how to work this one out? But then I worked out, I had no means to pull my pants up either. So I was sort of, you know, the conundrum's getting bigger, you know. So I thought, well, okay, I'll get back to the buzzer, you know, sort of thing. I'll get myself that way, you know, forgetting that I had a buzzer next to me. So I had sort of dragged myself up onto the walker again, and I was walking across, we'll call it a walk,
we'll
across
call it
the
a
room.
Walk.
And as I was going,
there
was
moving.
There was a young soldier, a female soldier, had walked past the hallway, and she wasn't nursing staff or anything like that. She was just this young soldier, and she was probably like 20 years old. So he got this, you know, man in, with his pants down to his ankles, you know, sausage hanging out and all that sort of stuff, unwifed, dragging myself across the, you know, the bed. And I've done the, you know, the Jedi, there's nothing to see here. This never happened. And she's just looking and laughing at me. And I said, please go and get somebody for me, will you? And she did. And that was, from that point, I realised that, one, I wasn't staying there anymore. You know, I might as well be at home. At least, you know, I could set my house up to look after myself, and nobody gave a shit where I was. So I passed my couple of little tests and I went home. And then I realised that I had to get up at like 5 o'clock every morning for my girlfriend to dress me and do all of those sort of things. And then an ambulance would come and take me, ambulance or a taxi would come and take me to work every day. So the defence were fantastic. And work, I mean, I went to the physio every day and I had a room in there. And I did that. But what I'd really done was just created a burden for my partner at the time. You know, she had to look after a child continually.
So she ended up being the nurse rather than the...
She ended up being my mother.
Yeah.
Rather than my partner. And the to her credit, she wanted to stay in the partnership. But I couldn't do it anymore because she had evolved so much. She stopped being my girlfriend. And
that relationship, that dynamic had really changed.
Well, you know, it was weird to tell a person, you know, that had done so much for you and loved you and all that sort of stuff, we can't be together anymore. Because, you know, it's gone too far.
Yeah.
And there was no, we tried to fix it up, but it still didn't work.
That does happen a lot.
It did. And she became very risk averse as well. You know, where I wanted to get better. And do things for myself. She was frightened to let me do things for myself.
Yeah, she was scared for you.
Well, there was two reasons in that. You know, when somebody looks after you all the time, you know, I call it unconditional love, but it's sort of, you know, it's conditional. You know, you keep looking after me, you love me. But you tell them, you know, thank you, I appreciate everything you do for me. I love you, you know, the person you are is amazing, you know, and it's affectionate and loving, blah, blah, blah. But then, you know, after you start trying to do stuff for yourself, they start arguing with you. And then
like
you're not telling them you love anymore.
You've got to have some autonomy over what
exactly.
You are doing. And it's not going to be the right way necessarily, or yes, you might fall, but it's the way you're doing it.
Yeah. I couldn't cope with that anymore. I was always, you know, I've been very lucky with my injury. At each stage that I had those really, you know, big downs, like, you know, when they told me based on the nerve conduction study that I would either have emancipated legs and I wouldn't walk again properly, or I wouldn't, just straight up wouldn't walk. I like anybody else, I had a little cry, you know, bloody I spent a bit of time alone. I rang my brother, I had a cry with my brother, I rang my best mate, I had a little cry on that. And then I said to myself, I wouldn't cry again. And I didn't. You know, like I'd had my moment in time where I felt sorry for myself. And then I said, well, I'm not doing this anymore. And I've been lucky with each one of my phases that I've gone through. You know, when you accept that normal shock that comes with it, you know, and you have to feel sorry for yourself, I suppose. But you also got to stop feeling sorry for yourself and make a decision to start moving forward.
Just go
how
forward.
How do I get better at what
I'm
doing?
How do I move forward? Or how do I, might not always be exactly forward, but move sideways and up a little bit.
Yeah.
But in a different direction.
Exactly.
But not backwards.
Never backwards.
Yeah.
Never backwards. Backwards, the only backwards that I ever allowed myself to have was when I looked at, when I got arm function back, I was so happy because I could use a wheelchair without some asshole pushing me. And it was just that little thing, I was so excited. And I, you know, got my first hospital chair and then I got my own day chair. And, you know, they were so exciting. But then I had more surgeries to do on my arm. So it meant that I had to go backwards because I couldn't push myself. And then I was back to having somebody. So I'd have to accept to myself, this is a point for the next 6 weeks. I'm going to have this operation and I'm completely immobilized from the arms up.
And it might be just 6 weeks.
6 weeks of backwards.
There's an end.
But it's a backwards to go forwards.
Yeah.
But they were hard times, to be honest. So to go back to, like, you know, having somebody wipe my ass for me again, you know, I hope that most people who are listening have never been through that, but the indignity of a full-grown man to then all of a sudden have to go back to having somebody wipe their ass, for me it was horrible. And I got left on a bedpan by a nurse at Westmead for like 40 minutes. And, you know, you got your small, medium and large bedpans, and because of the breaks in my back and my pelvis, I always had to be on the little one. And she had put a big one in, and I told her, you know, I said, I can feel that, you know, like, as much as I couldn't use my legs back in those days, I could feel them. And the spinal stuff was horrendously bad with the feeling. But then I'm beeping and I'm beeping and I'm beeping, and she didn't come. And in 45 minutes, I was crying. I was in so much pain, I was crying. And when she came in, I totally unloaded on her. And she walked out of the room and went and complained and said I was violent towards her. And then, you know, Kate came in and then looked after me, who was the lovely person. And she just couldn't believe this other nurse, you know, that she'd left me in that sort of condition. So, you know, having someone wipe an ass for me just reminds me of so much indignity and pain, you know, and the things that were done.
Do you still play wheelchair rugby?
That was a little bit later. So once I'd been home for a while and I was trying to find out, you know, what the status quo, you know, was I going to stay in the military, you know, and under what capacity and all that sort of stuff.
Sorry.
So Special Operations Command had an exchange to the US, to Florida, which Tampa is where their Special Operations headquarters is. And the boss said to me, mate, I'd love to send you on this trip.
So at this point, you are still in the military?
Still in the military?
Yeah.
Yep. But I hadn't actually paraded at work or anything like that, you know, since, you know, the helicopter crash. I was more, you know, living out of home and then doing that, you know, that transit into work. Anyway, they said, look, one of the things that I won't say I was struggling with, but I really, because I'd broken so many individual bones, you know, so I had, you know, limited use across legs, you know, the arms, the brain injury, you know, I had kidney and liver dramas, my nose was really bad, so it was the equivalent to 30 broken noses.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything, Pete, but, you know.
Yep.
Sorry. Well,
it was built from my ear, so it's a
right.
You know, a bit
okay, weird. Cool.
ABC filmed it, by the way.
They
can't
watch.
But I mean, I was really in that there was nobody for me to talk to about the holistic side of my injury. And you know, I mean, you meet somebody who's an amputee and you can have a chat to them, but you know, to have so many individual injuries, you know, the fatigue, the pain, all of that sort of stuff. So anyway, I got to go to the US, and because they had guys who had the same sort of thing, you know, the severity of the injuries was immense. So the three of us who went were three completely, there was an IED, there was an injured in training sort of thing, and myself. And we were all good friends that I'd known the guys, you know, for many years. We went over and I had the best time. And one of the Americans said to me, have you ever tried, who's their American cycle coach for their Warrior Games, said, have you ever tried a recumbent bike? And I said, nah. And he goes, I think this could work for you. He goes, you know, you're not going to cycle out of sight in a hurry, you know. I mean, I could barely sort of, you know, had that limited use. But he goes, I think this is something that could build strength for you. And I think that, you know, with your injuries, it could be tailored for you. So I rode a bike and I loved it. You know,
a recumbent bike.
And I felt like an idiot because nobody wants to feel like, you know, oh, I can't ride a bike or I can't do the things I did. But what it did was it gave me a little bit of independence back and that freedom. I'd always loved running and I'd always been very heavily into my running, or not always, but, you know, through my 30s and that. And I'd had that taken away from me and it gave me the feel back. So I thought, this is something that I want to do. And then on return to Australia, my boss said, you've been picked for the Invictus Games. And I was like, what's that? And he goes, man, the games are in Tampa, Florida. And they're
so
in like
to
2 weeks.
Right.
So I literally just got home and turned around and went back. And I got to catch up with all my American mates. Didn't even have bike or anything like that. And the Invictus Games in those days.
You were picked for the recumbent bike for the...
I was just picked to go.
Just to go.
Just to go.
Not as any
to,
special
to learn
event
about sport.
Or just to go.
Yeah. And so there was the wheelchair rugby team, which I had no function. I couldn't really do that. So I was not involved in that. I did some archery
did
stuff.
Did they really call that murder ball?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I did some archery stuff, and it was good. I really enjoyed the archery stuff. You know, I could work out ways to do stuff. And I really enjoyed that. And then, so the recumbent bike, the Americans said, we'll lend you a bike, because Australia didn't have any. And they lent me this old Magnum. It was the biggest piece of poo you've ever seen. And it was heavy as. And the Australian team uniform looked like, you know, something out of Cool Runnings. It was absolutely ridiculous. And because I'd, you know, got to that stage where, you know, like I'd been fit, had the accident, lost all the weight, and then I'd started to put it back on because I hadn't done any training. I just looked like a fat dude in a set of tights. It was very anti-superhero. And I was, like, embarrassed, like, with what I had to wear. And I didn't even know how to get the water bottle out of the bike. So I was out on the race, coming dead last, you know, right down the back. The little slow dude going, and then I had no water. And a dude rolled past me, and he had dropped his water bottle, and it was on the lanyard dragging behind him. And I was watching all the water spill out. And it was like a 30-degree day in Florida, and I'm going, it was bollocks, you know. So anyway, I finished the race, and my brother was there, and he came over and gave me this huge big cuddle. And he goes, man, from seeing you from when you woke up in Germany and you know, all the thoughts that I had about you being
dead.
How long
a period is this?
Maybe a year.
Okay, wow.
But he was cuddling me and he was crying and all that sort of stuff. And it was a really good thing for perspective for me. Just to understand where I'd been, what, you know, I suppose to see just how far I'd come across everything. And from that point on, I said to everybody, look, you know, I'm going to be on the next Invictus Games. And I'm going to win next time. Next time I'm going to come back and I'm going to get a gold medal. And they're like, yeah, you just keep doing that, Pete. Like, so anyway, I came back to Australia. I realised how much these things were worth. And I got a couple of people to help me. And I bought a bike. And I went back on to the next Games, which was in Canada in 2 years.
Oh, so every 2 years they have them?
Yep. So I went back to Canada. I went back as the Australian co-captain with Emma Kajolka. And I won both the cycling events, the crit, and also the sprint as well. So I double gold medaled on that set of games. I was in the wheelchair rugby team, but then one of my races conflicted against the schedule for the wheelchair rugby. So I pulled out of that and just concentrated on my cycling. And that went well. And then for the Sydney Games, so from there, I got really involved in the sport and really, really loved racing across the platform. And on the next set of games, I wasn't going to come back on the games, but the boss said, you know, put a nomination in, and, you know, you never know, you're like in the big city. And then on the very first camp, there was a guy called Matty Brumby there, and he had raced for Australia, he had tried for the Olympics and all this sort of stuff and didn't have a win, paraplegic, Navy guy. And him and I had just hit it off. He was just a great, great bloke. And he got picked for the captaincy, and the boss said, look, we want you to stay on and be part of that, you know, mentoring for him. And I was more than pleased to do that. So I was lucky enough to do a third set of games when, excuse me. And then on those games, you know, I ended up playing the wheelchair rugby, and we had the most fantastic team. A whole bunch of guys from Townsville had come down who were amputees.
It just looks incredibly violent.
Well, we won the gold that year. Well, it's not incredibly violent because there's so much protection around you.
So it's just the crashes and the sound of it. And
the sound of it make it worse than it is. And you go, so traditionally wheelchair rugby is played for quadriplegics. So people who have an injury to four limbs. You've got attacking players who are, you know, quite mobile. And then you've got defensive players who are generally the guys who have a greater severity to their injuries. So if you hit, you know, a person, you know, with multiple injuries hard, you're an idiot. You know, yeah, I get it, you know, some world competitions, blah, 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 and that type of stuff for, say, the guys out there now. But the guys don't do that. You know, you play smart. You know, you cut those guys out of the play. You put low pointers against low pointers and high pointers against high pointers, and it all sort of works out. So it's not, you know, you're not out there to murder the poor individual. You're just out there to do it right. And if you've got two good attacking players, they'll hit each other hard. And if you ever have the opportunity, and I suggest, you know, if you're ever watching it, Riley Batt, you know, the greatest player in the world, that man can roll past you and slap you with his own wheelchair. You're like, how the hell did he slap my chair? He was just rolling past. He's amazing. I could watch him all day. And I during the process, I got to meet all the Australian team, you know, the international team, the guys that go to the Olympics, that sort of stuff. Chris Bond, Rolly Batt, yeah, Edmo, all of those guys, they're fantastic guys. You know, they're really just great guys, and I got to play against them in games leading up to the games, and they really supported what we were doing in the Invictus space. So, yeah, it's great to be a part of.
Apart from the Invictus stuff, you're also doing a lot for veterans in other spaces as well, aren't you? And with the RSL. So you're the RSL ambassador now?
One of two.
One of two.
Yeah. So I suppose I've been really, really lucky. Opportunity keeps popping itself up to me. And when I got into the space, I did because I really struggled with pain. And then I went back to school. So Defence paid for me to go back to school, and I become a counsellor. And I started a company counselling guys with post-traumatic stress, depression, and those associated illnesses that come with that. And I wasn't charging anybody to do it. And I was doing fire and rescue, setting up training for fire and rescue in WA and being a part of that. And I started to see that there was a lot of people there who just weren't getting help. You know, and it's fine to, you know, to be in the cities and then, you know, there's so much, but if you're in the country and everybody's a volley, half the time you go into a job where you know these people or you're related to them. And I was watching...
Especially in small country towns.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we watch people, you know, went to a job where one guy lost his brother. You know, and he just, to sit there and watch another man just cry and cry and cry, you know, you think, well, how can I best help this person? So, you know, as part of that counselling stuff, and I was lucky enough to do a stint with the welfare section with WA Police and see stuff there, and I got to just keep learning. That then
and
led
so
into...
the people that you're counselling would relate well to you and probably open up more because it's yes. that peer-to-peer thing.
Yes. Well and truly.
Which makes such a difference.
A lot of the, you know, in a counselling perspective, you've always got to be careful of your disclosure. But your disclosure should be enough to build rapport. You know, if you don't have rapport, you don't have a client.
No, they're aware that you have some sort of, more than empathy, but a greater understanding.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
It goes a long way. And from there, I ended up being asked to do... so I did a little 13-minute sort of movie with a reporter around my pain journey. And it was supposed to be initially a mental health one where I spoke, and then the mental health stuff had shifted to pain because of a few things. And anyway, from there, Pain Australia then contacted me and said, we'd really love you to come on board and do some stuff for us. So I did that and then got offered a position through them. And that's been my story, I suppose. You know, I did some stuff in the RSL space. The next minute, you know, I had been asked. The CEO of RSL National is a very good friend. He asked me to come on as an ambassador, and then that grew. And then I got involved in the Royal Commission into Defence Suicide as the RSL representative. And then I got asked to be on the Stakeholders Advisory Board. And then it's just kept growing and growing. I get asked to do a lot of, a lot of talks around my injury and how... you know, one, how I got it, what the injuries were, and then how I was able to, I suppose, become who I am to now and what I do. So with everything that I've done, everywhere I speak, somebody else approaches me and goes, you know what, I think you'd be a good fit for us as well. And it's sort of grown. And because I'm retired from defence, so I'm no longer working for them. I've got my pension. I'm in a good position. You know, I bought my property when I was very, very young. So I really have no obligations to anything other than my family. So I, you know, had that discussion with the wife that, you know, this is a space that I want to do well in, and I want to be able to help other people. And lucky enough, she was supportive of that. So I'm not driven by money. I don't accept any money for anything I do. And if money is offered, it goes as a donation to the RSL or whatever. So I find that keeps me grounded.
And that takes that part away of it. Yeah. So it's just a more giving back.
I enjoy that I can help people. And I've always been super happy that some of the things that I say resonates with people. And if that can, you know, put people in a better spot, then that's where I'd like to be. Yeah, I think it's good. I think when there is money involved, you know, there's too many different aspects of, you know, say this, do this, want this, blah, blah, blah. Mm. You know, this is setting me up for the next, you know, paycheck.
You're beholding to people.
Yeah. And so I get to call a spade. I get to do what I want. It's funny because with the brain injury side of things, I still have some residuals. I've always talked a lot, by the way. I've always been that guy. So that's never been a drama. Actually, that's a lie. When I was a kid, I grew up away from everybody. I never got to talk to anybody. So when I joined the army,
I've made up for
not being able to talk. Actually, I don't know. I've lost my track. I started
that's
to think about
right.
my mum.
Oh, nice.
I was thinking as a kid, you know, with the, yeah. Being a, my mum worked away a lot.
Did
so
she?
I was by myself a lot.
We're going to have to wrap it up, Pete. Is
yes.
there anything that you'd like to add that we haven't covered?
I suppose in our space, you know, for those of us who have had brain injuries, you know, it's confusing. You know, one of my very, very good friends who wrote on my Facebook last night when I posted that I was coming down here with you, you know, he's really struggling. He swears all of the time. He still doesn't understand it. Hit a wall at 200 on a motorbike in the UAE. And he was also in an IED in Afghanistan. So join the two of them together, lots of injury.
Wow.
So
not wow in a good way.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But, you know, like, it's really confusing for us, that growth. People tell us, you know, it'll be what you got in 2 years, you'll, you know, that's
no,
all you got. That's
no,
bollocks, you know.
They
you
shouldn't
can,
say that.
But they do, you know. So, you know, for all of us, you know, if you keep focused, you keep thinking, you know, I did lots of memory games sort of stuff because I have shocking memory. I forget people's names that I've known all of my life. I never do introductions. I've learnt to be smart around, you know, what I need to do. If I know to do an introduction early, I write the bastard on the back of my hand. You know, when
did
I meet...
Did you notice at the beginning of this I forgot your name?
Yep. Yep.
But we got there.
But
that's okay.
That's what comes with us. And it's not a disrespect to her. It's just what happens with us. You know, I always have my phone in my hand and people, you know, might see that as rude. But what I'm doing is when I meet new people, I'm in notes and I write their name. And then I might say, oh, excuse me, I'm expecting an important call or whatever, and I just have to keep an eye. But I'm actually looking at their name. So it's taught me that, you know, for those things that aren't working so good, there's other ways around it.
Or when you have their name, you've got a little note about who they are and what they do or, yeah.
Yep. Buddy, I write post-it notes and put them on my steering wheel on my car because I find that somewhere that I'm a lot. And, you know, that reminds me stuff. So there's plenty of things that we can do.
And we talked about whiteboards as well.
Love a whiteboard.
Love a whiteboard.
Yeah. So many
whiteboards
in my
friends.
House. Yes. One on the fridge, one in the study. They're everywhere. But I mean, life gets pretty good for us. And on the other side of it, what's really cool about having a brain injury, we have an excuse when we stuff something up. And I blame everything on my brain injury. Your birthday? Oh, I'm sorry. An anniversary? Oh, I'm sorry. I actually had my anniversary date on the inside of my wedding ring.
Oh, and that's why it's on your watch.
And that's why it's there. And I can go,
oh, it's not today.
Feb, yeah.
I'm right this week. Oh, but what month is it?
We get there. And the more severity of the injury, I suppose, you know, the harder and more complex it is for them. But it's still not all doom and gloom.
No.
And there's always somebody out there who has it far worse than you. Always. So they're probably my closing points, I suppose.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Much appreciated. And it's been a pleasure and a delight to meet you.
Thank you. Same.
Peter Rudland was our guest on today's episode of Brain Injury Conversations. If you'd like to hear other conversations in our series, why not subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss another one? Until next time, I'm Cynthia.